You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Lucy McCann.
In this episode of LawPod UK, we're venturing into the world of sports law, and I'm delighted to have Joe Moore return to the podcast and also to be joined by Nick Jones for his LawPod debut. Joe and Nick, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy. We've got a Liverpool and an Everton fan on the podcast today, so what could possibly go wrong?
Is that a bad thing? Do you hate each other?
We get on.
Fine. Well, keep it civil, please. So what are we going to be looking at in today's episode?
We're going to be looking specifically at personal injury cases arising out of football matches, in particular those following a football tackle. So the classic case would be where a defender on one team tackles another player and causes that second player injury.
I have to admit that I'm quite relieved to have you both on the podcast to talk about this, as football tackles are way out of my comfort zone. And as you've said, Nick, you're both avid football fans. In the world of sports law, tackles are presumably only one of a number of ways that a player can be injured and which they can be compensated for, right?
Yes, absolutely. And as any Liverpool fans such as myself will know, players get injured in football all the time. Today, our focus is going to be on injuries following tackles caused by one player to another. There are plenty of other interesting legal issues arising out of sports injuries, those involving, for instance, care provided by club doctors and other medical professionals, and perhaps most obviously, given developments in this area over the past few years, the long-term impacts caused to players of ordinary play. And listeners may be aware of the rugby litigation, which is rumbling along at the moment. But those are matters to include in future podcasts.
So even though we're talking about a sporting context, I'm assuming that the recognisable building blocks of a negligence claim apply here.
That's right, Lucy. And I'm sure most of our listeners will be aware that the essential building blocks of a claim in negligence are, firstly, whether a duty is owed by the defendant to the claimant. Secondly, what standard of care applies to that duty? Thirdly, whether the particular action fell below that standard of care. And today we'll be looking at what evidence might be required in a football case to prove that. And finally, of course, whether that breach of duty caused injury to the claimant.
So turning first to duty, I mean, do players owe each other a duty of care? I'm assuming yes, otherwise it would be a very short podcast episode.
That's right. The key principles in these sports cases are pretty well established now. I'll refer to a couple of cases as we go, but we'll link them in the description as well so you can have a further read for yourselves. So Caldwell and Maguire is a court of appeal case about a jockey who's injured during a horse race. And the court noted in that case that players in competitive sports do owe each other a duty. And that's a duty to take reasonable care in the particular circumstances in which they're placed. And we'll come to what those circumstances look like as we go along. Another very famous case in this context, Waldridge and Sumner. It's another horse race case, but in this instance, a spectator was the injured party. The court said that in sports, it's a question of a duty of care, but not a duty of skill. And noted as well that competitors do accept some risk of injury in doing these kinds of sports. The duty is owed by one player to another, but especially in professional contexts, what you inevitably see, or what you almost inevitably see when it comes to court, is that the injured party won't sue the individual who injured them, but will sue the club. So the club is extremely likely to be vicariously liable for the actions of its players, and obviously for lots of reasons, most clearly being insurance and the amount of money that the club has versus the individual, you would normally sue the club. But the duty, nevertheless, is one player to another.
So that all sounds pretty straightforward. I imagine what's more complicated is the standard of care that you expect from players in sports matches.
Yeah, as I mentioned, Caldwell said that this level of care is that which is appropriate in all the circumstances. and the practical content of the duty that's owed does differ according to the pretty different circumstances of sporting activity compared to your normal day-to-day life activities. Caldwell went on to say that the relevant circumstances of a contest, so a sporting contest, include its object, the demands inevitably made upon its contestants, any inherent dangers, its rules, conventions and customs, and we'll come back to rules shortly, and the standard skills and judgment reasonably to be expected of a contestant. And so that reasonableness level does apply to so many of the kind of cases that we get in negligence, you know, all of them, it's inherently part of the test. And this was emphasized in 2008 in the Court of Session cases Sharp and Highland and Islands Fire Board, where the Court of Session said the test to be applied in the context of negligence rather than deliberate assault is whether or not the competitor in question has committed an error of judgment that a reasonable competitor, being a reasonable man of the sporting world, would not have made. So it's a classic standard of what a reasonable person in that position would do. But perhaps we'll have to have a bit of more of a chat about what a reasonable footballer looks like and whether that's a variable standard. Now, the test is reasonableness. It's not recklessness, but it's somewhere in between those two in reality. So what the cases that we've looked at and that we've seen in this kind of context say is that it doesn't have to be recklessness, but it has to be more than just errors of judgment, just oversights or lapses of concentration or skill, which any participant might be guilty of in the context of the fast-moving contest.
So just picking up on what you said a moment ago, Joe, reasonableness, concept of reasonableness, can mean a lot of different things in different contexts. So we're talking about football. How do you apply this standard of reasonableness in a football context?
Well, I think what's really interesting here is, of course, the point that Joe was just making. What comes out of the judgments, and I'll turn on to one, a particular one in a moment, is that to a certain degree, things happening outside the rules of the game, players doing things that might amount to a yellow or red card, are somewhat priced into the game. It's to be expected that these things will happen from time to time. And so you're absolutely right to ask what reasonableness really means in the context of a football game. And the first case that we've come across that really discussed this was from 1985, and it's a case called Condon and Bassi. I think it's quite interesting to have a look at the facts of this case, not least because I'm sure many of our listeners who've played Sunday League football will recognise the facts as having happened to them or in a game in which they've played over the years. And the game in question, it's all rather quaint, was a game from the Leamington local league between the Whittle Wanderers and Calso Football Club. This is what the judgment said. This Whittle player, upon realising that he was about to be challenged for the ball by an opponent, pushed the ball away. As he did so, the opponent, that's the defendant, challenged by sliding in from a distance of about 3 to 4 yards. The slide tackle came late and was made in a reckless and dangerous manner by lunging with his boot studs showing at about a foot to 18 inches from the ground. The result of this tackle was that the Whittle Wanderers' number 10 player, that's the claimant, sustained a broken right leg. Having gone through all that, the court discussed precisely what is the standard of care and what is reasonableness. And it found that the standard of care is objective rather than subjective, and crucially will vary according to the standard of the game. And it said in particular on that point that there will of course be a higher degree of care required by a player in a first division football match than of a player in a local league football match, such as the Leamington League. I think what's interesting in this case is that the defendant had argued that the standard should vary according to the skill of the individual player. I'm not sure if his client will have thanked him for that, because essentially what he was saying was that my client was so bad at football that the standard that was expected of him should be lower and that liability would be harder to establish against him. Unsurprisingly, the court said, no, it's the standard of the game. And I think, again, there's a number of more interesting points that flow from that and which haven't necessarily been addressed by the case law. For instance, what would the standard of care be if the game in question was between a very low-level club and, for instance, a Premier League club? And we see that from time to time in the FA Cup, for example, when a giant-killing team from the lower divisions manages to scrape their way through to round 3 or round 4 of the FA Cup and gets drawn against an Arsenal or a Liverpool or an Everton, Joe. Would it therefore be the highest or the lowest common denominator that would apply in that game? And For instance, would the standard of care on the lower league player now be judged against the standard of the Premier League player?
This raises an interesting question as well, which I think we'll come to if we discuss referees and the extent to which they can play into the assessment of liability, because you do have different levels of referees and different qualifications of referees depending on the level of football. So all professional football is refereed by qualified refs, but the level of ref does depend. So, for example, a referee who can ref a Premier League fixture is a level one ref, whereas my local team, Telford United, I think would be refed by a level four referee. And that might play into a court's assessment. For example, if Telford were to play Man City, like Nick said, which level do you judge them by? And you might find that the referee's various assessments of skill could play into that as well. I think usually in fixtures, though, you can assume that two players involved will at least be relatively evenly matched. So aside from the cases that Nick was talking about with two teams of very different levels, most of the time they'll be playing at the same level, they'll be in similar teams. And I think that Nick's right. There's not a very attractive argument to be made that a worse player on a professional team should be judged by a different standard. But we were talking about a charity match that Nick and I watched a couple of clips from, where a YouTuber, so not a footballer at all, not even a sort of semi-pro, put a pretty nasty tackle in on Kaká, one of the most skilled and famous footballers, who I'm sure you're very aware of, Lucy, who had this horrible tackle. Luckily, he wasn't injured. But if anything had come of that, it would be quite interesting to look at the skill that should be expected of somebody playing a really high-level match in that it's televised on a very skilled player, but themselves not being a professional footballer. You'd have this weird variable standard all on one pitch.
I mean, I don't know much about football. I don't watch it, but this doesn't sound like it's a rare occurrence to have two quite unevenly matched teams playing each other.
Well, I think this is just inevitably going to lead into a horrible joke about Everton and Liverpool playing each other, so I'm not going to answer it directly. But it would be normally in league matches, you'd be at a pretty similar standard, but a lot of these sort of tournament fixtures and obviously charity matches, you could see very variable levels of skill. Another part that we haven't mentioned yet in terms of reasonableness in a football context is the fact that it's played at speed and it's played at a competitive manner. So a number of the judgments have said that you need to take into account the fact that it's a contact sport. It is one that's played at speed, you know, not quite as fast as a horse race in some of the other cases we've seen, but speed, competitiveness, you know, a short period of time during which you have to make quick decisions. Nick and I have been watching some of the kind of classic tackles of footballing history recently to see where we think they might fall into these kind of legal analyses were they to come into litigation.
Very important research, Jo. Very, very important.
It's been a busy week, as you can imagine. So some of the things that we thought were interesting is the amount of pressure on the ball. So there's a famous tackle that I'm sure you will have seen. Oh, sorry, not a tackle, a famous incident between Ashley Williams and Van Persie, where Ashley Williams effectively kicks a ball at pretty close range into Van Persie's head while Van Persie's on the ground. This was interesting, we thought, because it's not really one within a run of play in the same way that you see in some of these tackle cases where two players coming together at speed, relatively evenly matched, and one makes a poor judgment while running towards another, for example. This is, you know, one of the players is lying on the floor. If this had gone to court, obviously it might be suggested that there was some level of intentionality or at least recklessness, given the absence of any clear reason to kick the ball in the direction or in the manner in which it was kicked.
I mean, you've given this example here, but how do the courts go about determining whether or not an action, say a tackle in football, does fall below a reasonable standard?
There are perhaps three different types of scenario to consider here, Lucy. As Joe's alluded to, recklessness is not the standard, but it is certainly a type of case in which the argument for negligence will be almost overwhelming. The second type of scenario is that where it's merely a momentary lapse of judgment or a momentary lapse in skill, in which proving negligence will be slightly harder. The tricky type of case is going to be the one that's in between the two. And that's the third category, which I'll move on to in a moment. Starting with the question of recklessness, listeners may be familiar with a case from a different sport, rugby, which was handed down by the High Court last year. And this is the case of Chernushka. In that case, the court looked at all the circumstances, including the behaviour of the players leading up to the tackle in question, and found that the defendant was so angry by this time that she closed her eyes to the risk to which she was subjecting the claimant and to the risk of injury, which the court found was at that moment clear and obvious. This is the case in which the defendant player tackled another player with such force that the claimant was left paraplegic. And so the cases that are going to fall in the middle of that are those where the behaviour of the defendant is slightly worse than a momentary lapse of judgment. And one of the tackles from history, which Joe and I thought might illustrate this, is that from the World Cup final in, I think it was 2010, and it's the famous, what came to be known as the Kung Fu kick from Nigel de Jong on Xabi Alonso. And listeners may remember, this was an occasion in which the ball was in the air and Xabi Alonso, the Spanish player, was moving towards the ball, attempting to head it. And Nigel de Jong from the Netherlands was also moving towards the ball, but raised his foot extremely high and it ended up ploughing into Alonso's chest. That is perhaps a case in which determining whether it's recklessness on the one hand or a momentary lapse of judgment is perhaps a tricky line to tread. And I think Joe's going to discuss later on some of the other factors that might come into the mix there as well, such as the high-profile nature of the game, the intensity of the game, and the speed at which the game is being played.
So Nick mentioned there the terrible injury that was suffered in Chinoshka. So the claimant was left extremely badly injured as a result of the tackle. But we've heard in a number of cases, Caldwell and Maguire, as well as Kerr and Willis, that the severity of the injury isn't illustrative of a lack of care. And that's the case for personal injury and clinical negligence generally. You can't just extrapolate from a bad injury that there was a negligent tackle or obviously one that merited a red card. And equally, you can do something negligent and get lucky, or something that would be negligent and get lucky, and somebody's not injured from it. So you can't just work back from, well, this was a bad injury, so something might have happened. And as we said at the outset, you consent to a level of risk of injury. It's just when that risk is the result of something unreasonable that legal liability arises. Moving forward to how you actually prove this, the burden of proof is on the claimant to establish that no reasonable competitor would have attempted the act that led to the injury or could have avoided the injury having attempted the act if the act wasn't a reasonable one to attempt. And that comes from Sharp and the Highland and Islands Five, or the Scottish case that I mentioned earlier.
So, Joe, you've told us that the burden of proof is on the claimant to establish the tackle or the action was unreasonable. If the defendant gets a red card as a result of their tackle, is that enough? Can the claimant just say, well, they got a red card, so clearly it was so beyond anything that was reasonable in the game?
It's an interesting question. Well, the answer is no. A red card certainly isn't enough, but the relevance of sporting sanctions has come up in a number of these cases and has led to some pretty interesting debate. It's been established, long established, and it's set out in Caldwell and Maguire that the rules and sanctions of the governing body of the sport, so in this case, the laws of the game, as they're called in football, which say whether you get a red or a yellow or a free kick or whatever, they are potentially relevant, but they're not determinative of legal liability. In a more recent case, so a case of Fulham and Jones, so it's a 2022 case, it's actually an appeal, but an appeal against the decision of a recorder about, again, a negligent tackle in sports. The appeal court found that the recorder had wrongly directed himself in making the decision that he made on negligence because he'd found that breaches of the laws of football would be very likely to amount to negligence. And the appeal court found that he erred in closely aligning serious foul play, as according to the laws of the game, with actionable negligence. Civil liability standard is higher than the laws of football because you get lots of people getting red cards and you get lots of people, you know, being sent off for dangerous play. There is a different level here that's required to show that something is negligent. We thought about it as well the other way around. Well, would a negligent tackle always be a bookable offence? So can you say, well, the fact that he wasn't booked can show us that it wasn't negligent? Well, we think the answer is probably in very strict terms is yes, something that's negligent must always, if the rules are properly applied, lead somebody to be booked. I think that probably has to be right. But the fact that somebody wasn't in fact booked during the match doesn't help that much because there's lots of reasons why the ref might not book somebody. They might not have seen the thing. They might have been looking in the other direction or not have had a good view. Or they might have made a flawed decision. So we've seen a couple of times where referees have commented after famous tackles that they would have made a different decision, you know, with the benefit of hindsight. And one that springs to mind, although it's a bit of a sore topic, is Jordan Pickford on Virgil van Dijk. So van Dijk, Liverpool player, was tackled by Jordan Pickford, Everton goalkeeper. Pretty nasty tackle, put him out for quite a long time. VAR said that van Dijk was offside at the time that the tackle happened, and therefore no sanction was given. They were allowed to carry on playing. Pickford wasn't booked because he was offside. So it was kind of null and void whether anything happened after he went offside. With the benefit of hindsight, Michael Oliver later said, so he's a ref, sorry, he later said that he should and could have still sent Jordan Pickford off for dangerous play, which is contrary to the rules of the game, even though it was also offside. So you can't rely on what a decision a ref makes at the time. And Nick can say, you know, the tackle that he was just mentioning, De Jong and Xabi Alonso, I think a sort of similar thing arose there where the ref, with the benefit of hindsight, had a different view, didn't it, Nick?
Absolutely, Joe. And I think one of the interesting things to note on that is that it's also the case that whilst the footballers themselves are playing a fast-paced game and making momentary decisions, so are the referees. And that's, I would suggest, something that the courts have been keen to take into account. And perhaps the De Jong on Alonso case is particularly interesting because, again, listeners may remember that the referee in that game, Howard Webb, was standing right by the tackle and watched it happen sort of yards from him, and yet still only gave a yellow card. And while he later expressed regret, which again just reminds us that referees can err in the moment and it cannot be determinative of liability whether or not they've given a red or yellow.
That's right, but it is still relevant, isn't it? And that's what the court told us in Fulham and Jones. This case was one where the recorder, this is reading from the judgment, the recorder was faced with a striking scenario in which a professional referee with an unarguably clear view of the tackle did not award a foul, let alone show Mr. Harris a red card. That feature was part of the evidential landscape which the recorder was required to traverse. So they're saying, you know, it's obviously relevant. It's part of the relevant things you need to look at.
In medical cases, you'd expect, say, an expert surgeon to tell us the standards that apply to performing the operation in question, if it's a clinical negligence case, for example. Do you have expert footballers doing this in football cases, or do you have other experts that can comment on the quality of the play in question?
So we've looked at a number of cases where they've used sporting experts, and what we see is that referees tend to be used as experts in these kind of cases. We'll look at two cases, a rugby and a football case, where this is done. But I think something to bear in mind is the potential danger, or at least the complexity of applying the laws of the game, which is what the ref applies on the pitch, as opposed to the law of negligence, which, for the reasons we've already discussed, is a different standard. But clearly, referees who are qualified to adjudicate these matches are probably the most experienced and the most likely to be able to give a clear view on what is and isn't reasonable, normal, safe play.
That's right. And that's why in the case of Chernushka and King, the rugby case from last year, the court was very interested in the expert evidence which was adduced by both parties. And indeed, both parties invited a referee to come along and give evidence. And specifically, the experts were asked to comment on whether the defendant was offside within the laws of rugby, presumably because had they been onside, it would have been indicative of play that was lawful. Secondly, whether the claimant had possession of the ball within the laws of rugby, again, going to the same question of whether the activity involved was lawful. Thirdly, whether, therefore, it was legitimate for the defendant to tackle the claimant at all. And then finally, how the defendant executed her tackle. So it's clear that the first three of those points are plainly within the sort of remit of a referee. Arguably, the fourth point is perhaps closer to something that a player themselves would be able to comment on. But we haven't come across a decision in which a player was asked to give evidence. I would suggest that were a defendant involved in a case where they were accused of a negligent tackle, they might want to bring along an expert such as Roy Keane, who would take a much more generous view to the behaviour of a defendant than some other players might do.
Yeah, and Gary Lineker on the other side saying that any kind of tackle is absolutely outrageous. So we heard expert evidence as well in the case of Fulham and Jones, so the 2022 case I referred to, again, a football case, both retired referees giving expert evidence. Keith Hackett called by Mr. Jones and George Cumming called by Fulham, both massively experienced referees, both retired. Keith Hackett was the expert who anyone who reads You Are the Ref, the Observer kind of comic slash game. And he also refereed a notorious 1990 league match between Man U and Arsenal, where there was a 21-man brawl, which is nearly everyone on the pitch. And George Cumming was actually previously FIFA's head of refereeing and co-author of the laws of the game. So he basically wrote the laws that he was applying. So pretty eminent experts. And in that case, in Fulham and Jones, it was interesting that one of the grounds on which the appeal succeeded was that the recorder departed from the expert evidence with no good reason. And that's just a classic standard for all types of law and any judicial assessment, which is that if you do depart from the views of an expert, you need to explain your reasons why.
So admittedly, I don't watch a lot of football, but is it right to say that often what's hotly contested is how a tackle actually occurred, like it is in rugby, because the player's quick, relatively far away, and the view, either as a spectator or from cameras, is often obscured by other players. So hence why people can disagree so fervently with the decisions of referees, both in football and rugby matches. So if you're bringing or defending a claim like this, how can you prove what actually happened if there's a factual dispute between the parties?
Well, I think this is where it gets particularly interesting, Lucy, because obviously so far we've been talking about high profile games where there's a lot of video evidence, a lot of people have been there to see it. But for listeners who are maybe not involved at such a high level, the question of what evidence they need and how they prove their claim is obviously going to be an important one. Now, put simply, the claimant must, of course, establish and the court must be able to reach findings on the relevant facts, which is going to include competitors' relative positions, their speed, how the players were moving at the time. Now, first and foremost piece of evidence that might be of assistance in that regard is, of course, video evidence and any kind of professional filming. And the rugby case that we've been talking about, Chernushka, whilst it wasn't a professional game, there was video evidence of the tackle, which was relied upon by the court. But what's further interesting is that even if you have that video evidence, it's clear that the court is still going to be interested in the perception of onlookers and anyone who was at the game. And this again comes from the case of Chernushka. In that case, the background and the events that had led up to the tackle were of particular interest to the court, given it involved reckless behaviour. And the court was therefore interested in the eyewitness accounts of those who were involved and the players on either side as to, in particular, the spirit in which the game was being played. And the court wholly accepted the evidence of one of the players from the claimant's side who told the court and gave evidence as to the spirit of hostility in which the game was played, the behaviour of the defendant's team in psyching out the claimant's team, and some very choice language, which I won't repeat on this podcast. And so it's clear that the court is still going to be interested in eyewitness evidence, whether or not you have video footage of the incident in question.
As Nick says, you know, video can't give you the full picture of what happens elsewhere, but also it might be in itself misleading. Those of us who watch football have seen a tackle that looks really bad when you see it slowed down in frame by frame, or something that looks obviously like an intentional handball when you see it in frame by frame when the VAR review is happening. But once they play it at normal speed, or if you're watching it in person, actually it looks like nothing because it happens so quickly that, you know, you can't assume that somebody can make that kind of split second decision. Something that looks intentional can in fact be completely accidental, but slowness can make it look more intentional. And this was highlighted by the court in McCord and Swansea Football Club, a 1996 case. And the court emphasised, and I think it's quite important when we think about slow motion replays, the court said it's a game sometimes played at a very fast speed and the players have to take very, very quick decisions as to how to react in relation to the situation immediately confronting them. It's easy enough for the armchair video watcher to replay the incident frame by frame and then decide how the player should ideally have reacted to the situation. But in the real world, that is to say, in the agony of the moment, in the heat of the game, the player has no more than literally a fraction of 1 second in which to make a decision. And they say that what can be considered a mistake or error of judgment when you look at a video frame by frame may be no more than an ordinary reaction, even of a skilled player. So there is this danger that comes with video evidence. However, having said that, having acted in a case myself where we didn't have video evidence because it was a pure amateur fixture, it's really difficult to get an idea of what happened. And we ended up with a number of witness statements which seek to say where people were standing. And even the witness statements of those on the same side were not completely in accordance with one another. And that's what you'd be expecting. You know, it's very common in things like car crashes and things like high-speed accidents of any kind that everybody will forget their exact position because you just don't remember that sort of precision. So it becomes really difficult, particularly, as Nick said, for the claimant on whom the burden sits to prove the facts that they need to about position, speed and movement, etc.
I think that raises a good point as well about just how critical the eyewitness evidence is going to be, because obviously it is going to be important, but it's worth bearing in mind too that the decision that Joe alluded to earlier in the case of Sharp and Highland and Islands Fire Board did find that a court is never bound to accept the inexpert value judgment of witnesses.
The court emphasised in Kerr and Willis, a 2009 Court of Appeal case, the caution with which you have to treat these kind of eyewitness accounts. The judge actually accepted that all eight witnesses on either side had been honest, but they just noted the difficulty in accurately, reliably, and without what they called innocent reconstruction, recounting a split-second incident from 4 years previously by the time it went to trial. And so unable to make a definite finding as to what exactly happened, found that the claimant's case hadn't been proven. So you don't need to say that the accounts are different because there is reconstruction or intentional reconstruction. It is simply very difficult to make these judgments. Another issue in evidence handling is about how the injury can give us a clue as to the nature of the incident. So as I said before, you can't say that because there's a bad injury, there was a negligent tackle. But what you might be able to do is look at the mechanism of how the injury was caused. And that might give you a clue as to what happened during the incident. So you see this in, you know, the kind of cases that we do, road traffic accident cases, where you look at the damage to the car and say, well, it was probably a head-on collision at this particular speed. And you can do a similar thing sometimes in injury cases. So, for example, if you have a compound fracture in the mid-shin, that might assist in showing that the tackle was possibly high. It may have been studs up. It may have been an over the ball rather than a through the ball tackle. So those sorts of things can also give you clues in a case where, you know, you're short on evidence or you're having difficulty proving exactly how the injury occurred.
So if a claimant can prove that they were tackled negligently by another player, the final question to establish liability is whether their injuries were caused by the tackle. What kind of injuries are most common and how do you prove causation? And on the flip side, how might you contest this if you're a defendant?
This is probably the easiest part of the test, because if you can show that there was a negligent tackle and somebody comes out of it with, say, a broken ankle, it's not going to be too difficult to draw a straight line between the tackle and the injury. There may be an element of a pre-existing condition, for example, if somebody had a weakness in knee, ankle, foot, etc. But in those cases, the eggshell skull rule would apply. So you'd say, you know, even if this person had an existing injury, it was at least exacerbated by this tackle, etc. You could start to get into some really interesting conversations about whether that person should have been on the pitch at all, whether there was fault on behalf of the team doctor or physio. You could be looking at whether this injury would have happened in any event, albeit potentially within the next year or two, which may limit their claim for future loss of earnings, for example. But just in showing that the injury itself, rather than the loss, the financial loss was caused by the tackle, will probably be simpler. But as I say, interesting points potentially for a future podcast in how we look at what that loss actually means in terms of earnings, in terms of the enjoyment of playing the game, if you're not doing it professionally, etc., and how much you can link that to the tackle, how much you can say, if it wasn't for this, or as we like to say in law, but for this tackle, I would have done X, Y, Z and earned however much money. And that's deserving of a podcast in itself because it throws up all sorts of interesting legal questions.
Yeah, I think you're right, Joe. I think we'll leave that for a future episode because it does sound like there's plenty that you can talk about on that question. One thing that just came to mind, Joe and Nick, is if, as a defendant, you could say, well, the claimant had the ball. I was directly in front of them. I was going to tackle them anyway. So what you have to show is that you only would have sustained the injury that you did sustain through a negligent tackle, but that you wouldn't have sustained that through a non-negligent tackle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a real legal puzzle, that one. I think probably the simple answer is that the factual circumstances of a negligent tackle will be very specific. So, for example, the position of the foot will be relevant to whether it's negligent, the speed of it, the angle of collision, and all of those things will lead to the injury. And it'd be really difficult to say you'd have got this exact same injury even if my foot was in X lawful position or I was going at this reduced, more reasonable speed. But I think an interesting point that is related to that is whether you say, and I've seen this in different personal injury cases, somebody had a pre-existing weakness, for example, and you say it's the sort of thing that inevitably will be exacerbated during normal play anyway. And so it was only a matter of time before that person became injured in that way. And so my tackle, while it caused you injury on that day, was not the reason for you having that injury in terms of you would have always had it at some point. It just would have been on a different day. And if you could show that in a claim for damages, then you'd be able to show that that person had really limited damages. It would be difficult evidentially. You don't need a lot of medical expertise, but you could show that, you know, they only lost four games because, you know, likely within the course of the season, they would have sustained that injury because of their pre-existing weakness.
Great. Well, I think that's a sensible place to end this episode. Nick, Joe, thank you so much for talking me through this. I've certainly learned a lot, and we're very grateful for you coming on the podcast today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
We've mentioned a lot of cases today, so we'll make sure that we'll link the cases that both Nick and Joe have mentioned in the blog post accompanying the episode.
And we can also put some links to YouTube, some of the tackles that we've mentioned for those that haven't already seen them.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Lucy McCann. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row